This is Beyond the Resume, the podcast that brings you the stories, advice, and insights behind some of the most successful people in real estate. Beyond the Resume is brought to you by Jackson Lucas Executive Search, the industry leader in human capital solutions. Here is Chris Papa and Lisa Flicker.
David Genovese. Or do you say Genovese?
You know, I grew up in Fairfield County, Connecticut, so we just anglicized it to Genovese. We de-Italianed it a little bit, but we're going to go back.
Davide Genovese. David Genovese, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
David, you are the CEO. I'm sorry, Lisa. You are the CEO of Baywater Properties in Connecticut. Can you tell us about Baywater?
Yeah, sure thing. Baywater is a locally focused investment and development company that I started in 2001. Candidly, I had been in investment banking. I worked at a great firm called Bankers Trust, which is where I think I first met Lisa.
Back in the 70s.
I'm not that old. I'm getting old. I'm not that old. From about 1989 until 2000, I was there for about 10 years in the real estate investment banking group, basically focusing on a whole host of different kinds of transactions with clients around the country. And then around the world, I moved to Prague, Czechoslovakia, when the world opened, when Eastern Europe kind of opened up, and spent about a year there. And then I went to London to help start a new investment banking group for Bankers Trust in London to cover Western and Eastern Europe, Central Europe. I was there, and then I came back in 1993 was there in the early phases of like the second generation of REITs, did a lot of asset sale work, some principal investing. And then when Deutsche Bank bought Bankers Trust, I left after a few months and went to Credit Suisse to start a new investment banking group. But in November of 2001, after September 11th, I had an epiphany. I had just gotten married and my wife was pregnant with our first child. And having been through like three or four mergers, I kind of got sick of it. And while I loved investment banking and I loved the companies that I'd worked for, especially Bankers Trust and the team I was a part of, I just had this vision of starting my own real estate investment company. And in November of 2001, I got up the courage to do it. And I left, you know, to basically focus on investments in Fairfield and Westchester County, value add type investments. I was originally trying to be the operating partner for a large private equity firm called TA Associates. I was very close to them from some work I'd done with one of the partners there, Jim Whalen, over the years. And I'd become a good friend and a client. And they never had a partner in this region. So we were looking at different opportunities. And unfortunately, what we quickly discovered was that there really weren't enough opportunities of a scale for them and the kinds of investments that they wanted to make. And so I started making smaller investments with my own capital, and then with like a small sort of small pool of friends and family. I bought an industrial park in Norwalk, Connecticut. Then Dick Gunthel, who was the head of our real estate group at Bankers Trust for a long time, and my mentor, called me because he'd invested in a surgical center business that wanted to open a surgery center in Wilton, Connecticut. And he didn't want to lease the property. He wanted to own the building based upon, you know, the magnitude of the investment he was going to have to make, or the company was going to have to make, in the surgical center. And so he called me and he said, "Hey, David, I have this great idea. Why don't you and I build a building?" And so we found a piece of land in Wilton, bought it. I worked on the zoning, the design, got the entitlements. He and I, you know, teamed up as equity partners and basically built the building. He had left Deutsche Bank and was, you know, kind of in between gigs that he had enjoyed. And so we built this building, and I did what I swore I would never do, is I became a developer. I literally, when I started this business, I said, I'm going to buy distressed buildings and fix them and try to own them for a long period of time. Development is just too risky. There's too many things that can go wrong. It can take forever and you miss a cycle and deliver in the wrong moment. And lo and behold, there I was in 2002 and three building buildings with Dick. But it worked. And we found that we could create more value, you know, through the development process. And so, I bought a few other smaller buildings in the area in Fairfield County. Dick actually went on to found with Paul Tarovsky a private equity firm called True North, they then became my financial partner in a number of distressed office investments, you know, throughout Fairfield and Westchester County. But while that was going on, I ended up finding my way into a couple of other development projects, you know, kind of the most visible of which was in Darien, Connecticut. In 2007 and 8, we built a building, a mixed-use building called 1020 Boston Post Road, which had, you know, first floor of retail, restaurants, a day spa, you know, second floor office, and the third floor apartments. And it worked. We delivered it, you know, in the fall of 08 into the darkest hours of the real estate market. But, you know, we bought the land well and built it well and leased it during construction. And so, you know, it actually proved to be a really good investment in a really transformational project for the downtown of Darien, which was in the early stages of trying to figure out how to just become a more interesting, more walkable, and more commerce-friendly downtown. Darien had, you know, historically been a very, very sleepy kind of bedroom community of New York, and the zoning regulations were extremely restrictive. And they, you know, for a reason, they didn't really want in the 40s and 50s, you know, a vibrant downtown. I think the attitude was,
take the riffraff out.
Well, most people worked in New York, and they were like, you know, we work in the city all day, and we come home on the weekends. And if we want action, we'll travel to New Canaan or Greenwich or Westport, Stamford or Norwalk. And so they just kind of left it the way it was. And so when you look at the demographics of the town and you look at where it sits in the middle of Fairfield County, it never really made any sense, you know, how sort of tired and kind of dilapidated it was. And people laugh when I say that because they're like, Darien, Connecticut, like, how could it be dilapidated and ratty? But if you know the place, and if you were here in the if you were here in the 70s or 80s or 90s, you know it really truly was.
This is a question that we get all the time, and I feel like you'll have an educated answer to it, which is students or folks starting out in their career, should they go into investment banking versus going directly into development? And I'm not asking you your opinion on work-life balance or anything like that, but I'm just curious, having kind of been through it and had a lot of peers who I'm sure have been through it, what's your advice to people who may or may not want to go into investment banking?
I wouldn't trade anything for the experience that I had in investment banking. I think that it gave me the foundation to you know, in the skill set to be able to do what I do now. I don't think I would I would have been able to do what I did with, were it not for the experience that I had. You know, it really gave me the foundation. And I think the key is, like, and I always say this to people, if you work for a small development company, especially a smaller development company, I mean, someone who would have come to work with me over the last 10 years would have maybe worked on one transaction a year. I feel like, you know, the investment banking experience that I had, you know, the reps, we always talk about, like, reps and just doing so many models, seeing so many different projects and transactions and interacting with so many different people, you know, that gave me the foundation and the perspective to do what I do now. You know, I always say to, like, even the bankers that I work with, you know, in the commercial banking relationships that we have, like, having been in finance for 12 years and having seen so many things, like, it makes me a better borrower. It makes me a better communicator of what I'm trying to do. It helped me, like, study the risk. A funny thing, though, you know, when I was in college, when I first got out of college or I was graduating, I wanted to go into development. And I was given an offer from the predecessor company to ESRT, Empire State Realty. And they wanted me to come join them to work on what was called Metro Center 2. It was the second phase of Metro Center at Stamford, the Stamford train station. And they said, this offer is contingent on that project starting. This was 1989. That project still hasn't started. Thankfully, I didn't, like, sit around and wait for the job. But when the nice guy who offered me the position, you know, called me to tell me that, you know, I was going to have to wait a while, he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know, maybe I'll go into banking and finance, like, because the world was pretty weird in 1989. And he said to me, oh, God, whatever you do, and he was a real developer, he's like, don't go into banking. You'll only focus on the downside. You'll never be able to be a developer. You know, you'll never have the courage to pull the trigger because you'll only think about what could go wrong. And you know, look, I understand his vantage point, and I, you know, I laugh about it now, and I, but I think, you know, being able to kind of assess risk from a different lens, using a different lens, but then, you know, maintaining a sense of optimism and looking at the upside associated with these things, you know, really made me a better investor, a better developer. And so, you know, for the most part, the things we've done have worked out fairly well. And it's just been, it's been a really extraordinary journey.
David, you mentioned risk. I mean, I think banking is, I wouldn't say it's not risky, right? You work a lot. You know you're going to generally make pretty good money, like overall. But development, I come from a family of developers, and it is like, I mean, I've seen the booms, I've seen the busts. I mean, it's a lot of risk, and then could be a big boom, and then, or a lot of risk, and it could be nothing, right? And so it's a very,
yeah,
you have to have a high risk tolerance to get in there. Like, what? It seems kind of really scary.
Yeah. It is scary.
Well, how did you get over that? Or like, did you just not know enough to be scared?
I don't know. No. I mean, quite the contrary. You know, I like I say, especially now with this new project we're working on, I mean, to be totally candid, like, I live in fear every day. It's not great. I don't love that part of the job. You know, I don't love it. But, you know, and especially in the moment right now, because the thing we're working on, the Corbin District project that we're working on right now, is larger than anything we've done before. So it's a bigger project. You know, we started actually building it during COVID, you know, during the pandemic. Phase one, we started in, you know, 23. So, I mean, you know, these were some kind of scary times. And, you know, over the 23 years I've been doing this, that's Baywater Properties, I've kind of been through three pretty scary moments, you know, two, really, 08 and then COVID. And, yeah, I mean, you know, in the beginning, I would say there were these moments where I really missed a paycheck and, you know, my bonus. I would always joke that, like, in, you know, February, I would just be like that anticipation of like your bonus hitting your bank account. And like it didn't happen. And not only did it not happen, but there was just like continuous outflow to feed my family and then, you know, to kind of build the business. But, you know, slowly and steadily, you know, we've built a business of, you know, owned assets, acquired and developed and owned assets that have enabled us to build a company that I'm really proud of. And, you know, I love the distressed deals that we've bought and the things that we've turned around. I love the challenges associated with those. But I also have really enjoyed this opportunity I've had. And it's really, you know, an honor in a way. And I don't mean to sound corny, but, you know, I grew up in Darien. So it's really been kind of a privilege to be able to work on this transformational project that, you know, has profound impact on my hometown, where I grew up, and actually where I'm now raising my family. So there've been so many levels to it, and it goes beyond, you know, just the financial aspects of what we do and the financial reward. You know, as part of Corbin, you know, we had to build affordable housing. Darien had has a 12% inclusionary zoning requirement. Now it's 14. They raised it to 14. And there were two or three other projects going on at the same time. And, you know, the big projects, Federal Realty completed recently a project in Noroten Heights in Darien, and John Vaccaro, who I worked with for a moment at Deutsche Bank, he's doing a development project near Federal's project in that same neighborhood. And then we've got the downtown project. You know, they're all complying with the inclusionary zoning requirement. I happen to have a number of friends who have children with developmental or intellectual disabilities. And I'm sort of witnessing firsthand, you know, how hard it is for them to find housing for their children as their children age and become adults. And it occurred to me that they would qualify for affordable housing. So I went to the town and I said, you know, I have this idea. I have a lot of friends whose sons and daughters need this kind of housing. What if I built my housing for that population that is sort of underserved? And the town loved it. So we built 12 units of supportive housing offsite for people who need a little more support and supervision and guidance. And then we're doing two units onsite for the same population, but that is a little higher functioning and maybe needs a little less support. And so, you know, again, it's just not just about the economics of what we're doing. It's like sort of, you know, finding myself now in this position where I get to do some really interesting things that help people has been really cool and totally, totally unexpected. It was not like 20 years ago when I started thinking about this, I was not thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to like, it's my downtown and the, where I grew up and then get to help my children. You know, I, that was never in my plan, but we kind of iterated into these unique and interesting opportunities because of our skill set and kind of position in the market. And I think maybe just interest in trying to do some good while we do our business. You know, Scott Reckler often talks about, you know, having positive impact on the community and like doing good while you do well. You know, I'm a big, big believer in that. I'm a big fan of Scott's, and I really take that to heart and try to infuse my work with good work, you know, good work for the community as I blaze the path here.
I love that. So when you have the housing that you're talking about, do you have services that go with that?
Yeah. So actually what we did, we partnered with a nonprofit from Greenwich, Connecticut called Ableist, whom I met through a friend. And, you know, because I'm not capable of providing those services. My firm is not capable of providing those services. And so we partnered with
Ableist. Was that at Bankers Trust?
They did not teach me that at Bankers Trust. So you know, we partnered with Ableist. They provide all the services. And actually, to be candid, and, you know, I can talk about this as much as you like, but we built the units with them as a partnership. I mean, we put up all the capital. And then on completion, we actually donated it to Ableist. So we gifted it to them. And, you know, the idea was it was deed restricted for 40 years. You know, when you build affordable housing, especially in a community like this, you know, given construction costs, the value of the asset is less than, you know, you paid for it, you spent to build it on completion because of the deed restrictions and the rent limits. So, you know, it was a part of a bigger transaction. So we looked at it and said, you know, if we built it and it's standing here, really, what's the value over 40 years to us? If we give it to Ableist, you know, there's some amount of our equity can be considered a donation to them. Some of it was sort of, you know, lost value through the income limit, the rent limit, but we donated it to them and they own it forever and they're not subject to the risk that like one day, you know, I change my mind and I don't want to do that anymore. I mean, they're in control and, you know, 11 people live there in the 12 units. One of the units is reserved for a staff member and it changed a lot of lives. So it's really awesome. Cool work. Yeah.
But you mentioned, your downtown and like, yeah, it'd be awesome if I'm just picturing going back to my hometown, doing what you did. That'd be pretty extraordinary. We've heard that you have studied Main Streets. Is that correct? Are you a studier of different Main Streets? So what makes a good downtown? What are your favorites downtowns? And what makes a good downtown?
That's a sad question today. It's a very, very sad question to ask today because, you know, what I did in setting out to do this, well, I'll back up for a sec. When I first started focusing on Darien, it was not honestly like as an investor. I had only my house in Darien. I had commercial properties in Norwalk and at the time Wilton with Dick. But our mayor at the time, this was going back to like 2002 or three, decided to try to, you know, start a dialogue with the community around improving the downtown. And she enlisted a group of volunteers to be a part of a committee. That would engage with the Connecticut Main Street Center, which is an offshoot of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. And they're like a management consultant of sorts that, you know, descends on a town and they give the town objective advice about how to like basically improve their downtown. And for the most part, they're working in downtowns that have really fallen into a sad state. So in Connecticut, for example, they worked with the city of Waterbury or, you know, the city of Torrington, like some towns that are kind of, you know, they had better days and, you know, a lot of industry had left, commerce had left, and a lot of empty storefronts and so on. You know, the Main Street Center people kind of laughed when Darien called. They're like, we didn't expect this call, you know, Darien, but they really did, because when you try to convince a zoning board to change its regulations to enable good development to occur, you know, you've got volunteers, well-meaning volunteers on the zoning board who generally are not real estate experts, and they're sitting there trying to do the right thing. But the people on the other side of the dais are like, you know, people like me or more sophisticated people, you know, armed with lawyers and architects and engineers, all telling them, don't worry, like, this is going to be great. We promise, you know, and they don't really know what the truth is. or they don't really know what the limits, the appropriate limits are. And so Connecticut Main Street really gave the town objective advice on how to like tweak the zoning regulations around the edges and, you know, set up a situation where, you know, good quality development could occur. And then the town, you know, the zoning commissioners and the volunteers in the town, really passionate, some more, you know, I would say with my my bias, some more constructive than others, you know, really engaged and tried to support good ideas. But in that journey that I've been on, I really went deep on trying to figure out what made a better Main Street. And so I did all this research. I met these planners from a group, a firm that works internationally called Duane Plater Zyberg. They're a well-regarded urban planning firm, probably one of the best regarded urban planning firms in the world, based in Miami. They led me to a gentleman by the name of Bob Gibbs, who used to work for Taubman. He was a mall guy who realized about 10 years into his career that he didn't like malls and he really preferred street retail. And so he became kind of the, I would say, one of the national experts on how to make great Main Streets. He's written several books. He teaches a class at Harvard every summer in the School of Architecture, which I've taken. Bob and I became very close. He worked on, for example, if you've ever been to Naples, Florida, he helped Naples kind of create that whole 3rd Street South area, 5th Avenue in Naples. And he'd often ride shotgun with DPZ on like their projects, like Celebration in Florida and Rosemary Beach and places like that. So anyway, great guy, deep thinker, taught me a lot about, you know, continuous sidewalks and engaging storefronts and, you know, the value of street furniture and street trees and, you know, just making places like really inviting and entertaining to walk down. Because, you know, what happens is, especially in a place like Darien, people generally, many of us, not all of us, but many of us lived and worked in New York and in New York City, right, with the storefronts of Madison Avenue or down in, you know, the Meatpacking District. You'd walk for an hour and not think twice about it. But if we all move out to the suburbs and it's like people get in their car and they're like, wait, what are you talking about? I have to like walk 200 yards from the parking lot to the store I want to go to, you know? And so the trick is to make that walk pleasant, safe, and visually engaging. And so a lot of the work that we've done, you know, has been to kind of bring that to Darien. If you know, like out here, if you know New Canaan or, you know, New Canaan's Elm Street or Greenwich Avenue, those are great retail streets. They're very walkable. They're entertaining. They're fun. There's great storefronts. But, you know, you get one block that gets, you know, blighted or, you know, where the storefronts aren't great or the store selection isn't great. You know, it's the mall people are experts in this. They know exactly what works best next to what and what will make people kind of walk further and go further and pass by stores and importantly, spend money. Downtowns are different because so often they're owned by so many different people who only care about like one property. Right? If you think about a downtown versus a mall, Simon owns a mall. Mace Rich, you know, Jackson Shea, who worked with me at Banker Trust now, CEO of Mace Rich, like they own a mall. Their goal is to make the value of that mall as high as possible. And they've got all these different levers they can pull and things they can do to like maximize the customer experience, the shopper experience, and make that mall worth more, make those stores perform better. So if the sales are higher, the rents can be higher. But a downtown is usually owned by like 1,000 people, 1 million people, however, you know, 100 people, 10 people. And they're not usually looking at it holistically. So the cool thing about what we ended up, you know, doing in Darien was we my partners and I acquired a lot of the downtown in Darien, a good chunk of it. And so, you know, we're able to have really kind of profound impact on the retail mix, the streetscape, you know, the walkability and the architecture of it. So anyway, that's a long way of getting back to the way this question started. You asked me, you know, what places did I study? I said it was a sad week. One of the places I went very deep on was Palisades Village, which was built by Rick Caruso in Pacific Palisades. I've walked, you know, every inch of that place probably 3 or 4 times over the years and took a lot of cues from what Rick Caruso did. I mean, he is a brilliant real estate developer, an incredible leader. It just so saddens me to see what happened out there. And, you know, he was able to protect Palisades Village, but, you know, the neighborhoods around, as you know, are just decimated. It's just so sad. But Palisades Village is an example of a great place. Brentwood Country Mart is a smaller cooler, kind of hipper, you know, shopping area in Brentwood, controlled by this guy, Jim Rosenberg, that has been really inspirational for me. Federal Realty's done some great projects like Santana Row in San Jose, Bethesda Row. These are some great places. But what I'm trying to do in Darien is, as I often say to people, something in between Pacific Palisades, Palisades Village, and Brentwood Country Mart. Because one criticism I would say, you know, I shouldn't criticize my peers, but I will say a lot of these places start to look the same. And a lot of these places, if you really look closely, you'll see like the rent rolls are kind of all the same. You know, every one of them's got a Sweetgreen, a Cava, a blow dry bar, a, you know, Gloss Lab, a, you know, F45. They're all kind of a lot the same. And, you know, and now it's a kind of a confluence of things. It's like developers are trying to pick successful concepts. And then private equity is backing these retail brands and just blowing them out. You know, there's a Maman on every corner, and you know, in Boston or DC, there's a Tate on every corner. They're great businesses, but like suddenly, you know, these communities kind of all start to look the same, and I don't want to do that. So
yeah, I live in San Carlos, California, which is kind of just north of Palo Alto and south of Burlingame, if you know. And so like my friend was mentioning yesterday, like Burlingame is a couple towns north, and it's become all brands. It becomes like, it's like every other place you just mentioned, right? It has all the same stores.
Yeah.
So San Carlos is not there yet. And I'm hoping doesn't get there. It still has like a lot of local shops. I mean, it's beautiful. It's great. It's like, it's very family friendly and walk downtown.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that these local stores, you know, they fear, and this has been a big part of my thing. Like, you know, they all fear, like in Darien, everyone say, oh, you know, the developer, you're going to buy all this property, you're going to jack the rents, and we're not going to be able to afford to be here. And, you know, my premise to them, my response to that is, if I build a great place and your sales go up by 50% because there's more people walking the streets and spending money in this place, you know, if your sales go up, you know, the rent can go up and we can both be winners. You know, if I artificially, you know, by edict say I'm raising the rents to, you know, Greenwich Avenue levels and like it's now going to be $140 a foot or $200 a foot, but the pedestrians aren't there and the sales aren't there, you're going to lose and I'm going to lose. So I really spend a lot of time trying to, you know, convince local, you know, store owners to kind of believe in what we're doing. And really thus far, it's working. I mean, we've been gentle on them. We haven't raised the rents much above where they were when we took their old buildings down, put them in the new buildings, but they all report pretty significant sales increases already. And we have not even finished the second phase of the project. So I believe strongly that when the second phase is done of this project we're working on, you know, if we get this right, which I think we will, you know, there'll be bigger sales, greater sales, and you know, over time we'll both win. But it, you know, you can't, that's the problem, right? Like someone looks at your downtown and says, oh, this could be so much better. If I fill it with the usual suspects, I can jack the rent and throw everybody out. And then the local people get scared. The local operators get scared and quit. You know, you got to bridge the gap. You got to, but we have, and that puts the burden on us. We have to make it happen and get the people there to support the businesses. And I always say, like, we're a long-term holder of these projects. So, you know, for 5 years, we'll keep the rents low. And then when the rent resets to fair market value, we'll have a conversation of where your sales are. By the way, it's a two-way street too. If your business isn't performing because it's not a good business anymore, which has happened, you know, it's not my fault if the photo developer, you know, closes. You know, with everybody using digital photography now, or if, you know, I don't know, pick another thing that just kind of went the way of the dodo bird. I don't
know. Horse and buggy. The horse and buggy shop.
Yeah, horse and buggy shop.
Develop, I mean, is super important. It's very local, right? Again, I mean, you're very local and you probably, when I worked for my uncle in Richmond, Virginia, he was a local developer there. He would like go to the coffee shop in the morning just to like hear, know everybody, what's going on. It's like, and so networking is super important, especially development. I heard you have a really great chili. Do you make good chili? And then two, you had an important networking event at a local event, right? So you got to be involved with the community. So I think it's a good lesson of how you can be involved with the community and meet people, and it leads to
how did you hear about the chili party?
Chris knows
I'm on a chili Reddit boards. I go deep into the chili Reddit.
That's pretty funny.
Wait, was there chili at the community event?
No, that's literally how that's literally how I met the mayor at the time, who basically, my neighborhood, I just moved to town. My neighborhood had this chili contest. My wife and I entered. We did not come near winning, not even close. But I met the mayor at the time, and she said, that's when she gave me the pitch. She's like, I heard you're into real estate. I heard you're a decent guy. Like, and I'm trying to put this committee together to, you know, start a conversation about improving the downtown. Would you be a part of it? And that's literally how the dialogue started. You know, in 2002, I think it was.
It's all local.
That's pretty funny. That's some deep research, Chris. I'm impressed.
Well, it's all Julio. Julio is, I know he just looks like a pretty face, but he loves chili.
No, but you know, the thing is, I would say, you know, I have to figure out, I mean, I'm 57 years old, so I have to figure out what I do next and where we go from here. I've loved, you know, the work that I've gotten to do over the last 20 years. I'm really proud of it. I've put together, I think, a great team, and I really enjoy this. And I love this business. So many aspects of it. It is scary, and you live in a little bit of fear all the time, but I love it. But I don't think that in the way that I've done this to date, I don't think I would have ever taken the risk I took in a market I didn't know as well as these markets, right? Because I do walk these streets every day, and I do, know the community innately, because I've lived here for so long. I mean, I grew up here, I left, I came back. And I joke that, like, I'm kind of a walking focus group. I mean, it causes a little chaos in my life from time to time. Like, my wife will say, and maybe your dad had the same, or your uncle had the same experience. Like, if I go to the grocery store to pick up a gallon of milk on Saturday because we're out, you know, I might not come home for an hour because, you know, Mrs. Johnson's going to grab me and ask me about, you know, what new businesses are coming to the new project, and when am I going to be done, and when will the traffic associated with the construction slow, and you know how it goes. So, but I don't think I would take this kind of risk in a place I didn't know as well. We'll see what happens next. I mean, I may just do simpler things going forward. Mixed use is the most complicated kind of development. You know, the infrastructure requirements, you know, the complexities associated with, like, interweaving residential, retail, commercial. You know, the Corbin District project, you know, it's got about 100,000 feet of retail or first floor space, retail, fitness, restaurants. It's got 110,000 feet or so of office and 116 apartments, excluding the 12 we built for Ableis. So, you know, there's just a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, David, if you think Mrs. Johnson is going to grill it, was good at grilling you, wait till you enter the hot seat.
Oh! Are they on it? I'm not on it yet?
You're on it right now.
Oh, okay.
Where is it? Awesome. Yeah. Temperature rising?
Yeah, there
Mrs.
we go.
Johnson's got nothing on us. Oh, he's taking some water. Okay.
So we'll start you up easy. Do you have any books or podcasts that you'd recommend?
I love How I Built This by Guy Raz.
Yeah.
The best.
Absolutely love it. I love the fact that, like, when you listen to it over time and you listen to multiple ones, I feel like every entrepreneur's story kind of has common elements of, like, the initial epiphany, the idea, and then the beginning of execution and, you know, a little taste of success, and then the near-death experience that extinguishes the whole thing, right?
It's the hero's journey. The hero's journey.
Yeah, I love Guy Raz. You know, I don't want to talk about Matt Slepin on a, you know, Jackson Lucas podcast. I like the real voice, real estate voices, but I think this is like this is going to be the one that takes you up.
Have you been on the Real Estate Voices?
No.
Have you been on this one? All right.
Yep. You ask about a book. This is a funny story, and I'm going to give him a shout out. This book, Building Optimism by Kobe Lefkowitz. About 6 months ago, the former chairman of our zoning commission in Darien forwarded to me a tweet that he'd seen by Kobe Lefkowitz with pictures of my project, the first phase, saying, this is like one of the greatest examples of mixed use development I've seen in the country. You know, the Corbin District, blah, blah, blah. And I never heard of him. I didn't know who he was. So I just simply wrote him a message and I said, Kobe, thank you so much for your kind words. I really appreciate that you like our work. And so So suddenly now he's in my network. I think I hit him on LinkedIn. He published that book in November. I bought it. I read it over Christmas. I devoured it. It's about, you know, mixed use places and kind of the value to communities of creating beautiful places that are not generic, walkable. It literally, I mean, he's kind of a new urbanist at heart, and it's all, and he's an architectural, he studied architecture at UVA, but he's a developer, writer, designer. He's young, but he's very, very thoughtful. And I've loved the book. And actually, he came to visit, and I took him on a tour of the Corbin District this cool. week. Yeah, so we actually met in person. But I that's my most recent book that I've loved. But I'd say How I Built This Among Podcasts.
Yeah, that we kind of modeled this podcast after that a little bit, like your yeah. story hanging onto it. And do you have a signed book by Larry Silverstein on your desk, like Lisa does behind her?
I do not. I do not. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
I'm signed to Chris.
Signed to me.
You know. I want to read that. I have not read his book yet. I need to get that book.
Come on over and borrow it anytime.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Jonathan Rose has a really good book about cities too, which is really good. I read that recently, or I've been reading it for like years. All right. What is your question number two? What is your most memorable deal? You talked about the one with the ableist.
Most memorable deal. Well, in my whole career.
Yeah.
I've had some really interesting experiences. I mean, I worked in Prague, you know, in the early days of the privatization of you know, formerly communist party-owned properties. I worked on the privatization of a hotel. That was pretty wild. You know, I was on a team. I was on a deal team. I was like an analyst. I mean, this might be when I met Lisa. And literally, at one point, the mayor of Prague, who was our client, called and said, and these were like dark days. We were all just trying to figure out how to stay alive. It was like 1992. 91, 92, really dark times in commercial real estate. And Bankers Trust had an economist who was Czech and was very dialed into like the intellectual elite who, when the wall fell, all became ministers of industry, minister of privatization, minister of tourism. They all became governmental officials leading like the transition back to a capitalist society. And so we're working on this deal, and I'm like the 23 years old, you know, punk. And the mayor of Prague calls my boss, calls Dick Gunthel, and says, through a translator, you know, this isn't really working. My whole political career is at risk if this project doesn't work. I want boots on the ground. I don't want your bankers flying in on planes, like parachuting in for 3 days, you know, staying in fancy hotels, eating out, and then leaving, and then coming back, you know, the next month or the next week. Like, I need boots on the ground. So Dick Gunthel calls us in and says, you know, okay, mayor is demanding that someone go live in Prague and work out of his office on this project. Who among you wants to do that? And of course, the senior people on the team were like, well, I have a wife and family. Like, I can't move to Prague. And I was like living in a, sharing an apartment with a friend. I raised my hand jokingly saying, well, I'll go. And they looked at me and they went, are you serious? I go, yeah, I'll do that. So, you know, I got tagged and I ended up in Prague for like a year. Working on that project. And then that led to getting to work in London on some really interesting projects. I worked on them. I worked with, on the project with Scott Malkin, helping him build value retail. We made the first investment in value retail, building the Bicester Village in the UK. He went on to create an incredibly successful company and portfolio of, you know, the first among the first value shopping centers in Europe. I got to work on. I sold the Hotel Bel Air in Bel Air, California. That was pretty wild. I worked on Rob McGuire's company, selling Rob McGuire's company. That might have been the most interesting deal. We were selling Rob McGuire's development and investment company in 2001. And Rob was just an amazing visionary and had built some of the most, you know, iconic buildings in Los Angeles and in California. And we went to contract in August of 01. One of the properties, well, some of the properties included the gas company tower, the library tower. Now it's called, I think, U.S. Bank Tower. And Rob controlled with Morgan Stanley, I think it was, Playa Vista, which included like the hangar, the airplane hangar where Howard Hughes built the Spruce Goose, which is now Google's L.A. headquarters. We went to contract with Trizicon, one of our clients, in August of 01, and then September 11th occurred. And Trizic, you know, was in due diligence. They walked away because they didn't think they could insure the Library Tower. It was the tallest building west of the Mississippi. That was a really amazing situation to be a part of. And it ended up, you know, Rob ended up going public and ended up creating, again, another great company, and then had some troubles later, you know, when the financial crisis hit in 08. But those were some of the highlights in my banking career. You know, in Connecticut, those are highlights. That would be kind of recognizable to people.
Love that. You're up, Liz.
I'm up. So I'm sure you've done a tremendous amount of hiring in your time here. What do you look for when you hire somebody?
You know, to be candid, I haven't in this next era of my life, this chapter of my life. I mean, my team is only 16 people big. And we, you know, when I started, it was just me. I pulled my father out of retirement, who knew something about mechanical systems. I knew nothing about anything. And having a father who was like super handy, my wife jokes, I can barely change a light bulb. It's kind of pathetic. You know, I've brought into the business, honestly, people who, I mean, I recently hired some really experienced construction people and development people. Kate Perez joined me from CIM. She's amazing, helping run the Corbin project. Doug Kravis joined me from a Papa John Construction company we'd worked with a lot. He wanted to just transition away from being a pure construction manager. Our property managers, for example, had no experience in real estate whatsoever. They were just smart, good people. You know, I one of my heroes in business is Danny Meyer. And, you know, I just love him. And I love, like, kind of way he approaches his business and team, and how he built Union Square Hospitality. And, you know, I read his book, if you haven't read it, Setting the Table, is an amazing book about, you know, being hospitable in business and kind of treating people well, both your team and your clients, and kind of the balancing act between, you know, doing what's best for clients and doing what's demanded by clients and doing what's reasonable for your team. I've hired a lot of people who didn't really have experience in real estate, but were just smart, hardworking, and know how to get stuff done. And, you know, it's really been great. I mean, we're definitely, you know, we've added over the years, but not the same. And it's about culture and stick-to-itiveness, and like, and people who don't like look at this as like a nine to the one problem with being in investment banking, I guess I would say, and then trying to go from investment banking to a job, a business like this, or a side of the business like this, you know, investment banking, I mean, we were like maniacal. Like, we would, you know, if someone said, you know, walk across this bed of hot coals, you know, and until 3 a.m, I would do it. You know, we were just so committed to whatever it was, and you know, the rewards were great for performance. You know, finding people who will do whatever it takes to get the job done, you know, without that same kind of economic reward, because, you know, these positions, to be honest, like, don't reward economically in the same way as an investment banking job or a big private equity or other job like that. So it's hard to find people who just really care, but I've been really lucky in that I've been able to find people who really identify with and believe in the mission that I kind of laid out. And, you know, they're passionate and they're awesome.
That's a great answer. Yeah. So as you know, we don't do this stuff alone. Can you shout out to one or two of your mentors along the way?
Oh, sure. I got a few. Dick Gunfall, for sure. Who ran the real estate group at Bankers Trust for a long time. He, you know, built an incredible team of people, you know, who you've probably interacted with over the years, and you should pull onto this podcast, like Kia Buckley, who is the CIO of Dune, Debbie Harmon, who's the co-founder of Artemis, you know, David Brush, you know, Lowell Barron's the CIO, he might even be now the managing partner of Brookfield. I mean, the people who are in our group, what they've gone on to do was really just so amazing. And it was a magical place, largely due to Dick's leadership. There was a woman who worked with him also, Robin Sheeman, who he kind of called his human capital expert, who, you know, really was sort of the glue that pulled us all together. There was also this awesome guy who worked with us. Sadly, he passed away, as did Dick. Dick passed away last year, but Howard Guja was this amazing guy who I worked with, who also really taught me about the importance of having fun while doing this work. And, you know, Howard, so many of the people that I worked with at Bankers Trust were like, they went to like Harvard, Yale, Northwestern, Stanford, you know, blah, 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 name the Ivy. Howard went to SUNY Farmington or Farmingdale in Long Island, and he lived in Babylon, and he was a surfer, and he drove Dick crazy because if he would get up for work in the morning and before like the internet, if he found out that the waves were up at Gilgo Beach, he would like come to work late or not come to work. And Dick would just go batshit crazy on him. But, you know, somehow Howard, you know, was just the guy who every year, no matter how, he never knew how he was going to do it, but he would always just bring in this like monster transaction. And clients loved him because he was like the most street smart, down to earth guy who, like, we always said, if you were in a trench in World War One and you needed to be with any one of us, who would you pick? Everybody picked Howard. And for me, as a young banker, you know, learning the trade and, like, you know, learning how to kind of conduct myself, you know, I just remember there were so many moments where, like, you know, we'd be working like 100 hours a week, and Howard would grab me, pull me into his office excitedly and say, okay, I'm going to tell you something now. Like, you can't look like you slept on your desk last night. Like, you, now you're a managing director. Now you're a vice president. Like, you got to lead, and you got to look like you're able to lead, not like you slept on your desk. And he'd say, you know, don't fly into the flame. You're flying into the flame. That was one of his great lines. I do, you know, over time, I just kind of knew what that meant. It was like, okay, time to just pull it back a little bit and like make this sustainable. And I, you know, if it weren't for all the mergers, to be honest, I probably would have stayed in investment banking. I'm happy I didn't, but, you know, I really loved it. I learned so much from that cast of characters. It was an amazing journey.
I feel like somebody should write a book about that.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah, that group was amazing. I mean, Lisa, you probably know all of them.
Yep, and they're all special people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the list is long.
Yeah. Well, David, that's the podcast. That was awesome.
Thank you so much. It was worth the wait.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, listen, I'm so sorry, you know, but doing what we do, it's like we've had a couple of crazy schedule constraints, and I'm really grateful for you, and I'm happy to help spread the word. I think you guys, this was fun to do. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Resume, a Jackson Lucas podcast, where we take a deep dive into the career journeys of some of the top minds in real estate and equip you with the knowledge to move forward in your path towards the success you've envisioned. Make sure to like, share, and subscribe to Beyond the Resume. Be grateful for your support. All episodes of Beyond the Resume are brought to you by Jackson Lucas, building inclusive and diverse businesses through talent acquisition. Visit us at jacksonlucas.com